ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, this is Tom Gilson with ID, the Future. I have the privilege with a friend of mine, Kate Cover, of leading an apologetics fellowship group that meets in the Cincinnati and Dayton, Ohio area. A couple of meetings ago, we had a visitor by Zoom, Jonathan McClatchy, and a fellow with the Discovery Institute. We had question and answer time with him, but it was preceded by an actual podcast recording, which I led there. There were audio problems, you'll hear that, but I think you'll still enjoy the podcast and enjoy hearing from Jonathan McClatchy, who I will introduce as we move into the actual event. For information on the Apologetics Fellowship, by the way, you can go to apologeticsfellowship.org. That's apologeticsfellowship.org. Today, we're going to hear from Dr. Jonathan McClatchy. Jonathan is a Christian writer, international speaker, debater, assistant professor at Sattler College in Boston, fellow of the Discovery Institute, with a bachelor's degree and honors in forensic biology, a master's in evolutionary biology, a second master's in medical and molecular bioscience, and because he's quite the underachiever, he has a PhD in evolutionary biology. He's participated in dozens of moderated debates around the world with representatives of atheism, Islam, and other worldview perspectives. He's spoken internationally, and he is interested in promoting an intelligent, reflective, and evidence-based Christian faith. So my first question for you, Jonathan, is with your background in biology, in a field where the intelligent design perspective is not, shall we say, terribly popular so far, how did you get interested in this study?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I did my bachelor's degree in forensic biology at the University of Strathclyde in Scotland between 2007 and 2011, and grew a fascination over those years in the wonders of the molecular world. Was often bewildered by how anyone could go through a four-year university program in the natural sciences and come out an atheist at the other end, because the evidence seems to me to be quite compelling for the truth of theism and span so many different disciplines, both in the life sciences as well as in the physical sciences. But during my undergraduate, I was fascinated by molecular machines in the cell and how they work and how they function, and how many of these systems require multiple subcomponents that have to work together in unison and have to be very specifically crafted towards achieving some higher level objective. I became fascinated with how you can develop robust inference to design and the epistemology of design detection. So that and then because I was so fascinated in this question of origins, I then went on to do my master's degree in evolutionary biology, and I worked for a year between 2012 and 13 with the Discovery Institute. Later on, I came to become a fellow of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture, and then of course went on to also get another master's degree in molecular biology, and then I did my PhD in the evolution of the eukaryotic cell cycle, which is a subject of fascination for me.
Your fascination with molecular machines reminds me of why I didn't study biology, among other reasons. I had a very bad biology teacher, and I mean very bad in the sense that he taught us Charles Darwin's life story six times, and I don't think he did it because we needed to hear it that many times. I think he forgot he had already done it. But another thing about biology that bothered me when I was in high school back in the mid-1970s was they said that the cell wall lets sodium in and out and potassium in and out and calcium in and out. And I kept wondering, how does it know? And what the science has come to since then would suggest that we're starting to understand that. Is that right, Jonathan?
Yeah, we're constantly growing in our understanding of the wonders of the cell.
So intelligent design proponents talk a lot about irreducible complexity. It's a topic that's been in the field, has been under discussion since Michael Behe published a book in 1995 called Darwin's Black Box. It's been very controversial. Could you just tell us what irreducible complexity is, first of all?
Absolutely. So irreducible complexity, as defined by Behe in Darwin's Black Box in 1996, basically refers to a system that is comprised of several well-matched interacting components, the removal of one of which renders the system completely non-functional. And so the idea is that this presents a challenge to the New Darwinian evolutionary scenario of stepwise evolution, because evolution has no end goal in mind. It has no telos in view. It's not a goal-directed process. Rather, it's an unguided, mindless, stochastic process of chance and physical necessity. There's a random component, namely genetic mutation, which are sifted by the mill of natural selection. Natural selection preserves those combinations of gene variants that promote the survival of the organism to reproductive age so that they can produce fertile offspring and pass on their genes. But it doesn't, it's not able to visualize a complex endpoint and look into the future and realize that end goal. That's a unique feature of intelligent causes. And so there's a number of examples of irreducible complexity, perhaps the most famous one, or the kind of the flagship example that has become most famously associated with irreducible complexity, would be the bacterial flagellum, which is a rotary motor that propels bacterial cells through a liquid. It's been a subject of long-time fascination for me, and Behe championed that as an example in Darwin's Black Box. Another example would be bacterial cell division machinery, and there's a number of different features of the bacterial cell division machinery that I think support the idea of irreducible complexity. So one example would be so during bacterial cell division, the cell has to elongate to, in the case of a rod-shaped bacterial cell, double its original length, and then you have the formation of the what's called the FIT-Z ring that polymerizes or assembles around the division septum, and then the cell bifurcates into two daughter cells. And part of that process involves synthesizing, breaking the peptidoglycan, which is a cell wall in bacteria. And the peptidoglycan has to be severed at various points. And there's proteins known as autolysins that perform that severing. And then you have to resynthesize the peptidoglycan cell wall. Various proteins involved there. You have bactoprenyl, which shuttles the peptidoglycan precursors across the cell membrane. You have the penicillin binding proteins that perform the cross-linking of the cell wall and so forth. And this is an example of an irreducible complex system, because you have to have a very careful coordination between the severing of the peptidoglycan cell wall and the rebuilding of the cell wall. In fact, the penicillin binding proteins that perform the cross-linking, as their name implies, are the target for penicillin drugs, because the penicillin interferes with that cross-linking process and results in the cell not being able to resynthesize its cell wall during cell division, and because of the osmotic pressure, it basically bursts. So there's just a couple of examples of irreducible complex systems.
So the first one you mentioned was the use the term rotary motor, and that's not just a metaphor, is it? The bacterial flagellum.
Yeah, exactly. The bacterial flagellar motor is a rotary motor that propels bacterial cells through liquid in Salmonella or E. coli, which are the model systems for studying flagella. They spin at speeds of up to about 17 or 18,000 rotations per minute, RPM. In some organisms, like Vibrio species, they spin at speeds of up to 100,000 RPM. They have a virtually 100% energy conversion efficiency, and they're plugged into a signal transduction circuit, so they get feedback from the environment, and it's called chemotaxis, a very, very elegant system. And unlike man-made motors, they actually have assembly instructions to build themselves from the inside out, and so they actually assemble themselves, and it's a fascinating process to study, but it requires very carefully choreographed gene regulation.
And the second example you gave, with a list of molecules that most of us are not using in our everyday vocabulary, I think what you're saying there is that the sequence has to happen in a given order, and it has to all happen or else none of it happens. Is that a fair, extreme condensation of what you were saying?
Yeah, exactly. So if you had the mechanisms for breaking the cell wall, for example, and the autolysin proteins that are the autolysin enzymes that are involved in that are themselves under careful control because it can result in programmed cell death. But if you evolved the process for breaking the cell wall without simultaneously having in hand a mechanism for rebuilding the cell wall, that would be very problematic, because as the cell divides, it's not able to rebuild its cell wall, and because of the osmotic pressure, the cell is going to burst. So yeah, that's an example, I think a strong example of an irreducibly complex system.
And you've done some work in DNA replication. Can you give us a ground-up view of what that's about, starting with maybe even what DNA is and why replication matters?
Absolutely. So DNA is the information storage medium of the cell. It stores information in the form of four chemical subunits that we represent with the letters A, C, T, and G. So adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. And the sequential arrangement of those chemical subunits, or those letters, if you will determine, among other things, the sequential arrangement of the amino acids that form proteins. So in the case of the protein coding sequences of genes. And so the DNA will undergo what's called transcription into an intermediary molecule called messenger RNA. And then it will be, in the case of a eukaryotic cell that has a nucleus, it will be taken outside the nucleus into the cytoplasm. And at the cytoplasm, it gets translated by a two-part chemical factory called a ribosome into a polypeptide sequence, which will then fold into a functional protein. So that's basically, in a nutshell, DNA. There's a language system called the genetic code, by which the three-letter words, so in DNA language, words are comprised of three letters, and we call them codons, and these three-letter words each specify a particular amino acid. And then there's three stop codons, and there's one start codon, AUG, which codes for methionine, and methionine is always the first amino acid in any polypeptide. So in terms of DNA replication, the purpose of replicating DNA is to prepare for cell division. In eukaryotic cells, this is known as an S phase of the cell cycle, where the cell is undergoing cell division. And the processes are very similar between eukaryotes and prokaryotes. So eukaryotes have a nucleus in the cell, prokaryotes don't. So we are eukaryotes, whereas bacterial cells are prokaryotes. And then there's another branch of prokaryotes known as archaea, which have some differences from bacteria. They tend to inhabit very extreme environments of temperature and pH, for example. What's interesting is that although the mechanisms between the three domains of life are very similar for DNA replication, it's widely thought that the DNA replication machinery actually evolves twice, because the proteins are not homologous between the bacterial branch of the evolutionary tree and the eukaryotic and archaeal branch. So homology refers to similarity in this case, protein structures that results from a common ancestor. They don't appear, the protein components, even though the mechanisms are very similar or seem to be analogous, the protein components are not themselves homologous. And so it seems that the DNA replication machinery evolved convergently in these two branches of the tree, the branch leading to eukaryotes and archaea, and the branch leading to bacteria. Now, so DNA replication is preparing the cell for its division. And so that's essentially the purpose of DNA replication. There's a number of different components that are involved in DNA replication machinery. And if any one of those components were missing, you wouldn't have DNA replication that worked half as well as it used to, or a quarter as well as it used to, but it would be broken. And so this is a classic example of an irreducibly complex system. So what proteins do you need? Well, you need to initially open up the DNA double helix for copying and perform the unwinding of the DNA double helix. And this is initially carried out by initiation proteins. And then you have the protein called helicase, which is an enzyme that breaks the hydrogen bonds along the DNA double helix to prepare for copying. And of course, you don't want the DNA double helix reannealing during copying. And so you have proteins called single-stranded binding proteins that bind to the single strands of DNA to prevent them from reannealing during copying. You have the DNA polymerase that actually performs the DNA replication. You have the topoisomerase that alleviates supercoiling ahead of the replication fork. Because of the torsional stress that is induced by the unwinding, this can result in these supercoils forming, and we think about an old telephone cord forming a supercoil, and so this is alleviated by a class of enzymes called topoisomerases, which basically cut one strand, they pass the other strand through the break, and then they reseal the break. And so that's very important, otherwise the DNA could break during copying. You have to have a protein called primase, which is basically it's a form of RNA polymerase, because DNA polymerase is not able to commence DNA replication itself without a free chemical group known as a 3' hydroxyl group. And so that has to be synthesized for it by an RNA polymerase called a primase, because the primase, unlike the DNA polymerase, can synthesize the ribonucleotides without the need for an initial 3' hydroxyl group. You also have, with respect to the lagging strand, so you have two strands of DNA, right? You have what's called the leading strand and the lagging strand. The leading strand is in a 5' to 3' direction, and that's the direction that DNA replication takes place. But the other strand is anti-parallel, meaning that it's running in the opposite direction. And so that strand has to be synthesized backwards. And so that's done in a discontinuous fashion by looping this other strand around and then synthesizing these short RNA sequences called primers by the primase enzyme, and then extending from those discontinuously, extending from those separately or individually, forming what are known as Okazaki fragments, which are just these short DNA fragments, which then later have to get glued together, and there's an enzyme for doing that called ligase, and the primers have to get removed by RNA excision enzymes and replaced by DNA, and so forth. So if any of those components were missing, and that's just the peak of the iceberg, then you wouldn't have a system that worked half as well as it used to, or a quarter as well as it used to, but it would be broken. So for example, you also have so without the DNA polymerase, for example, then no replication could take place at all, right? The RNA primers would be laid down at the origin of replication, but there would be no further extension from those primers. The DNA ligase, which links the DNA fragments that are produced in the lagging strand, if it were missing, then the newly replicated DNA strands would just remain as fragments. There's also a sliding clamp, by the way, that clamps the DNA polymerase onto the strand of DNA to prevent it from falling off during copying. So without the sliding clamp, the DNA polymerase will frequently fall off the DNA template, and that would make it too inefficient for replication. In the absence of the RNA excision enzymes, the RNA fragments would remain covalently attached to the newly replicated RNA fragments. Without the DNA helicase, the DNA polymerase would stall because it cannot separate the strands of the template DNA ahead of it, and so little or no new DNA would be synthesized. If you didn't have the primase, then the RNA primers cannot begin on either the leading or the lagging strand, and so DNA replication would not be able to begin. If you didn't have the single-stranded binding proteins, then the DNA strands would re-anneal before they could be copied, and so that would also not work. You also have another enzyme called telomerase, which resynthesizes the end of the chromosome, because of the RNA primer, which has to get removed, the sequences of the chromosomes would shorten with each round of replication. And so you have a riboprotein known as a telomerase, which resynthesizes the end of the chromosome to prevent shortening with each round of replication. So again, if any of those components were missing, then you wouldn't have a system that worked half as well as it used to, or a quarter as well as it used to, but it would be broken. And so how are you supposed to, by a stepwise Darwinian pathway, put together this sort of system with this higher level objective without knowing where the target is? So that's really the nub of the issue when it comes to irreducible complexity.
So just to put this in context, let's talk size for just a second. How large is a typical DNA molecule in nanometers or whatever?
So it depends on the species. So for example, for humans, our DNA is about 3 billion base pairs of DNA, 3.4 billion base pairs of DNA. There are other organisms that have bigger sequences. There are other organisms that have shorter sequences, but bacteria tend to have far smaller sequences of DNA than we do.
And you could fit how many of them into the end of an eraser on a pencil or something like that? They're very...
Yeah, I haven't calculated that, but they're very small. If you were to take all of the DNA out of your cells and stretch it end to end, you would certainly die.
Oh. Pardon me. How many different parts and steps have you counted out? How many were involved in that list of different proteins, different peptides, et cetera, that you counted out? How many members of that list are there, which you say? Have you counted it, or can you guess?
Of the ones I listed?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mentioned polymerase, ligase, the sliding clamp. You also have a clamp loader that loads on the sliding clamp, incidentally. You have the RNA excision enzymes. You have the DNA helicase, the primase, the single-stranded binding proteins, of which there are multiple. You have the telomerase enzyme and so forth. So, yeah, there's a significant number of these proteins.
One less is not just one less. One less is death. So how did this happen evolutionarily? How did evolution bring this about?
Well, this is a big question because DNA replication is, of course, necessary for self-replicatability. Without being able to replicate your genome, you can't replicate. You can't divide and segregate your genetic material. And so you can't really appeal to natural selection to explain the origins of DNA replication without presupposing the existence of the very thing you're trying to explain. Because DNA replication is necessary for self-replication, and self-replication is necessary for differential survival, which is itself a prerequisite for natural selection. So you can't invoke natural selection to explain the origins of DNA replication machinery without assuming the existence of the very thing you're trying to explain. There's also causal circularity problems. So DNA, as you know, codes for proteins, but proteins are needed to replicate the DNA and to transcribe it into messenger RNA and so forth. And so there's this chicken and egg paradox or causal circularity problem. And of course, origins of life theorists often respond to this by postulating what's known as an RNA world scenario, which is to say that RNA was the first information storage medium prior to the DNA protein world. You had an RNA world. And RNA can not only serve as an information storage medium, but it also RNA can fold into a three-dimensional structure. It can form complementary base pairs with itself. And so it can perform some catalytic activity. But the catalytic activity that can be performed by ribozymes is very limited relative to that can be performed by protein enzymes. And the ribozyme engineering experiments have not shown that ribozymes can completely self-replicate. And so that's also a significant challenge to the evolutionary paradigm for accounting for these sorts of systems. So I don't think that the RNA world scenario, and also RNA, of course, is very unstable relative to DNA. So it's got an extra 2' hydroxyl group, which makes it more unstable, and also it's single-stranded and not double-stranded, and so forth. And so, yeah, I don't think the RNA world really explains the causal circularity problem either.
So I think what you're saying, the question was, how did evolution cause this to happen? I don't hear you saying that there's an answer to that question.
Exactly. I think that these observations are wildly surprising on the hypothesis that of naturalistic evolution. But they're not particularly surprising if we suppose that a mind was involved. And this is how I would argue that we should conceive of evidence. This is a classic Bayesian conception of evidence, that evidence is that which renders a hypothesis more probably true than it was previously. So evidence is measured in terms of a likelihood ratio of the probability of the evidence existing, given the hypothesis that's true, on the numerator versus on the denominator, the probability of that same evidence existing, given that the hypothesis is false. And to the extent that that's top heavy, that's the extent to which you have evidence for your hypothesis. And when it doesn't need to be the case that the evidence is highly predicted on the hypothesis, it just has to be better predicted on the hypothesis than it would have been otherwise. And so in the case of an iridescent complex system, like what we see with DNA replication, the hypothesis that a mind was involved in the origins of DNA replication renders the evidence that we observe not particularly surprising, but that evidence is wildly surprising if we don't suppose that a mind is involved. And so you have this overwhelmingly top-heavy likelihood ratio that confirms the hypothesis of design as being very strongly supported by this evidence.
And this is not the case that we don't know enough and therefore we must think God did it. We don't know how it happened, therefore we're going to conclude there was some supernatural agency involved. This has been an increasingly strong case as we have grown in our knowledge, rather than a decreasingly strong case.
Exactly. The more that we've learned, the stronger the design inference has become. And in fact, theism was widely taken for granted throughout most of human history. In fact, prior to Darwin, the majority of the critics of Christianity would actually be deists rather than atheists, right? You have the deist controversy, and Darwin came along and he provided a mechanism by which you could allegedly explain away this appearance or illusion of design without recourse to an actual designer. Now, if Darwin got it wrong, as I contend that he did, then we're back to where we were before Darwin, where the evidence of design in nature, in particular from living organisms, is just overwhelming. And in fact, the challenge to naturalism in the case for design has become far more exacerbated or enhanced since the times of Darwin, in view of our modern advances in both the life and physical sciences. So we now understand the information basis of life, and which was unknown to Darwin. He didn't even know about genetics at the time, even though Gregor Mendel was a contemporary. And apparently he had Gregor Mendel's work, although he hadn't read it at the time of his death. And now we understand the information basis of life. We understand that molecular machines run the show in biology and so forth. And that world was completely hidden to Darwin. And I think that it really makes the case for design 1,000 times stronger than it was prior to Darwin and his Origin of Species.
We're close to the end of what we have to discuss here, but I'm wondering if you have anything else you want to add before we close our conversation.
No, I think we covered quite a bit. One additional nuance I'd add to iridescent complexity, which I think circumvents a lot of the criticisms that are sometimes leveled against the concept. So if you read the likes of Ken Miller or Nick Matsky or some of the other critics of iridescent complexity, one of the most common criticisms is, and this is true, for example, in Nick Matsky and Mark Palin's 2006 Nature paper, where they criticize iridescent complexity of the bacterial flagellum, is that some species lack this particular protein component, therefore it's dispensable and it doesn't contribute to an iridescent complex system. And the way that I conceive of iridescent complexity is not so much in terms of structural components, but in terms of functions that need to be performed. You can change the identity of the structural components, replacing them with other proteins that perform the same job, or by different ways of achieving the same functions. And so it's the functions rather than the structural components that's the crucial part of iridescent complexity. You can even have one function being performed by multiple proteins, or you can have one protein that performs multiple functions, but really the functional components or the functions that need to be performed to achieve this higher level objective is more important than the identity of the components itself. So that's something to bear in mind.
Good. Well, thank you, Jonathan. It's been a treat and pleasure to talk with you about this, learn some more about iridescent complexity, the DNA aspect of it. We appreciate your being here with us on ID of the Future.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
For ID of the Future, this is Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.